Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments, but three interviews today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Mark Levine and Gilbert Achkar on the uprisings across the Middle East. Then, towards the three-quarter-hour mark, we'll hear from Bhaskar Sunkara, who's one of the editors of a new magazine called Jacobin, about that project. No time for any commentary today, except to say, how about that State of the Union? Obama is clearly channeling Ronald Reagan, a man he wrote something of a love letter to in USA Today about a week ago, and offering upbeat sentiment masking contradictory or awful policies. Like, how's he going to fund all those nice investments in green tech and education while embracing a spending freeze? More on all that when he unleashes a budget in a few weeks. Okay, a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the revolutions across the Middle East. That was a bit of a song called Beyond the East from the Egyptian band Beyond East, which describes itself as playing extreme oriental metal from the Flowers in the Desert compilation. According to a member of another band on the album, the arrival of metal and rap in the Middle East was like a flower appearing in the desert in repressive societies. A collection was put together by my first guest, Mark Levine, whose day job is as a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. His book, Heavy Metal Islam, was a study of youth culture in that part of the world. Mark Levine. Welcome, Mark Levine. I must confess that, I guess like most Americans, I hadn't paid much attention to Tunisia before a couple of weeks ago. But what's been going on there? Give us some sense of the political background to the rebellion that has taken place there.
The general background of what happened in Tunisia is that there was a dictatorship for several decades that was very much tied to Western interests, especially France and the United States, and that was tolerated and even supported by Western governments because it was quote-unquote secular and because it fought against what we considered Islamic extremists who were against us. There was supposedly a kind of bargain struck between the regime and the Tunisian people whereby the government provided them with unprecedented access to education, to birth control, to rights for women, and other kinds of things that would please people in Europe or the U.S., and in return the people basically had to allow the regime to remain in power unquestioned for decades. This was always a false bargain. It was never a bargain that the people of Tunisia signed on for, but it was one that the West tolerated. And, you know, as this system evolved, it began to fall apart, really because the regime was just so incredibly corrupt and just became so involved in every aspect of the economy, really just stealing from people right down to the level of the street vendors who could barely scratch out a living. And, of course, it was one of those street vendors who was humiliated by a policeman who had been forced to either pay bribes or to stop selling the fruit that he needed in order to sell in order to live, that sparked the whole revolution to begin with. So it's a situation where, you know, we weren't paying attention because, like you said, most of us don't care about Tunisia because it's not doing anything to us. But on the ground, there was a slow evolution of people as the corruption and violence from the regime got worse that eventually decided they had nothing left to lose. And that's what sparked the revolution there, and I think it's the same exact situation that's going on in Egypt today.
France is the former colonial power there. And what has been its recent role in Tunisia?
Well, I mean, it's a major trading partner, if not the major trading partner, and its role in supporting the government in some way is similar to the U.S. role in supporting Mubarak. I mean, you know, as long as the U.S. signals to the Mubarak regime that will allow him to do pretty much whatever he needs to remain in power, he will be able to, or he will continue to use whatever violence he thinks necessary to squash the protests. But as soon as the U.S. might say, that's enough, we're not going to support anymore, the regime would evaporate. France doesn't have exactly as strong a relationship with Tunisia in terms of direct aid, but clearly the French were quite happy to keep a stable dictatorship in power because it allowed French economic interests to continue there and prosper. It was good for tourism. It basically, and it especially helped staunch the flow of immigrants or migrants to France and other parts of Europe from Africa. And that was really the main concern. But again, you know, these things can't be separated from each other. So as long as the French were supporting a very corrupt and violent and despotic regime, the people were going to seethe and try to leave the country and get to France. So in the end, it became a self-defeating policy, and certainly the almost complete quiescence of the French while this revolution was happening, you know, was going to leave a bitter taste in the mouth of many Tunisians for years to come.
And is there any political organization or agenda to the rebellion, or was it just a sort of a spontaneous uprising?
Well, nothing's ever spontaneous. You know, again, it's just like any kind of fire. You have to have the conditions that are ready, and then the spark sets it off. What's happening in Tunisia is exactly probably what will happen in Egypt if there's a successful overthrow of Mubarak, which is that you have a coincidence or a concurrence of many different groups, all of whom share a desire to get rid of the old regime because none of them benefit from it or are in fact hurt from it. But once the regime is gone, you're going to see all the individual interests start coming out, and it's going to be much harder to retain any kind of large-scale social solidarity. In Tunisia, you have a large middle class, which basically wants jobs, doesn't want to have to deal with all this corruption, and wants a democratic system. But, you know, in order to have this kind of joblessness taken care of so that you can have hundreds of thousands of new jobs created, which is really at the root of this problem, you're going to have a fairly substantial change in the economic system of Tunisia. And that once that would happen, that's going to challenge much of the middle or upper middle class and certainly elites who at this point might be backing political change, but certainly don't want massive economic change. And as soon as you have the separation of the economic and political motivations behind the revolt, you're going to see people turning against each other.
Who, if anyone, is running the government now?
I don't think anyone is really running the government. I mean, certainly you have the caretaker president, you have the prime minister and the parliament that has not been dissolved per se, but the protesters are not allowing them to function really in any meaningful way because most people on the street understand that unless you tear out this regime by the roots now, the elements, the vested interests of that regime will probably manage to maintain themselves in power even with a new system. And if that happens, then the corruption will continue and the violence will come back from the regime and this whole revolution will have been for naught. So there's a sense that you really need to take out everyone. But on the other hand, if you take out everyone, because there's been no real opposition for decades, there's hardly anyone left who knows how to run a government. At least that's the claim. So that's going to be what's sorted out, really, on the streets and within the larger national psyche, if you will, whether or not it's worth the risk of uprooting the regime wholesale and not having enough people who know how to run a functioning government, or whether the whole system is so corrupt that even starting from scratch would be better than the risk of allowing anyone from the ancient regime to remain in power.
Now, the Tunisians seem to have inspired some of their neighbors to similar uprisings. So let's talk a bit about those. Now, Algeria also, right?
Well, Algeria and Egypt both face very similar situations. They face large youth populations which have far too few jobs and very little prospects for the future. And this is you know, the same situation that pervades in Palestine, the same situation that pervades in Iran, the same situation that pervades across the entire Middle East and North Africa. So, you know, it really depends on how much legitimacy regimes have. Jordan is another country that is much more unstable than it might seem. And it's really going to depend on a calculus that I don't think anyone, including people in any of these countries, yet can determine, which is how many people are willing to risk everything? That means there's freedom, you know, being tortured, beaten, even killed in order to change the system. In Tunisia, you saw suddenly there were so many that the revolution was, in a sense, kind of easy. In Egypt, we're not sure really right now. I was just on the phone with a friend in Egypt, you know, people are still trying to understand whether enough people can come in the streets to overwhelm the military and the police. And the moment that happens, the whole thing is over. So the government, of course, understanding that, has to figure out whether it needs to use all its force now because it's the last chance. But if in doing so, it will alienate so many people that everyone will come out to the streets. So we're at a really dangerous moment in a country like Egypt, because if the government decides to use massive force, as happened in Iran, it could be a bloodbath, but that bloodbath could then be the catalyst for the real Egyptian revolution. It's just impossible to tell at this point.
Yeah, now Slavoj Žižek has written about how in revolutions often people lose their awe of the security forces. And when that happens, it's all over for the regime. So something like that happened in Tunisia, right?
Well, it happened like that in Tunisia. It happened in Iran in 1978 and 79. And remember, the Savak, the Iranian secret police were as feared as the Tunisians or the Egyptians, and equally as brutal. But when enough people had been fed up, that coming together in a massive crowd gave people the courage, and it just created a feedback effect that brought more and more people into the streets. And each death of a peaceful protester brought more people in, and it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. But those moments are impossible to judge when you reach that critical mass, and it really depends on how well the regime knows its own people. The Shah, for example, didn't know his own people. Ahmadinejad, 30 years later, obviously understood that if he used enough violence, he could quell these people, and he succeeded. We don't know yet whether Egypt and Algeria or Jordan are going to be the Iran of 1979 or Iran of 2009. That's really the question that we have yet to determine across the region.
Let's talk some more about Egypt. How tenuous is the regime's control there, do you think?
I think it's extremely tenuous. I mean, you could see this regime gone in a week if enough people come out to the streets. I think Clinton's remarks yesterday were really horrific when she essentially and completely ignorantly said the regime is stable and we see that the regime will be able to work through this. That really was an insult to all the Egyptians I've been in touch with. And I think she understood that because today she took a slightly stronger tack with Mubarak, saying that we expect them, you know, to allow peaceful protests. But it really depends on the army and the police. At some point, if these protests continue, Mubarak is going to have to make a decision to kill large numbers of people to stop them. And at that point, the police and the army are going to have to decide whether they're going to do that. If they are willing to kill large numbers of people, hundreds if not thousands of people, then they might be able to suppress them today, but it'll explode soon enough. If the police refuse to do that, then you will see him on the next, you know, living next door to Ben Ali in a few weeks. So it really depends on what the police and the army and the security forces are willing to do. I think a gauge of how desperate the situation is for them is that apparently the regime has already been releasing thugs, even criminals, onto the streets to attack protesters. So if you're at the level where you have to release thugs and criminals to do your work because you can't be sure that the police will do it, you really are in a very shaky situation.
Is there any kind of opposition in Egypt, any kind of alternative power structure in waiting, or is it a similar vacuum as in Tunisia?
Egypt has an incredibly developed and sophisticated political class, whether it's in civil society, all the opposition newspapers or organizations, or whether it's potential candidates for president like Mohamed El Baradei, who's the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, or Ayman Nour, who ran for president in 2005 under the encouragement of the U.S. and then was arrested and spent many years in jail. So there clearly is a class of people who could assume the reins of government. The question really is that you have the elite in Egypt who really benefited from Mubarak's policies and increasingly have begun to run for parliament and become part of the political class as well. So you have the joining of the economic and political elite, and that's going to make it harder to get a clean break. But you do have a large oppositional movement who is certainly capable of governing the country if Mubarak is gone. But again, the army might allow Mubarak to go, but the army has also benefited incredibly from his policies and from sort of neoliberal policies and the so-called privatization of Egyptian industries, which many of which have gone into the hands of the military, of military officers. So they might allow change at the top, but they're not going to allow a wholesale change in the system. And at root, what this revolution is going to be about is the poor and the middle class wanting a serious redistribution of wealth. And the elite, like in any country, is not going to willingly do that.
Do the poor and the middle classes have any kind of political outlet, or is this just a matter of dueling elites?
No, the poor, they do. The labor unions, which were crucial in Tunisia, are also very crucial in Egypt and are going to be the backbone of any successful revolt. In fact, there's been several what my friends call mini-intifadas in the last 3 or 4 years in Egypt, basically large labor strikes that have set the stage for this kind of large-scale revolt. So there is an institutional framework for taking on the regime, and you know, if it's going to happen successfully, it's going to be a combination of the labor unions with ultimately a large share of people who are aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, and then various other professional associations like the Lawyers Syndicate and journalists and others within civil society who are going to have to come together to basically make an unstoppable force that the military and police come to understand can't be stopped, and therefore will be willing to sacrifice at least Mubarak and the current regime in order to maintain a semblance of power.
That was Mark Levine, a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. Now, for another perspective, let's hear from Gilbert Achkar. Achkar, born in Senegal, grew up in Lebanon, but left that country in 1983. He now teaches at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. Gilbert Achkar. Welcome. It's been quite an impressive uprising across the Middle East over the last couple of weeks. Let's start with Tunisia. What's your evaluation of the situation there?
Well, the big question is how the political situation will end up. And it's caught between, of course, as is obvious, between some form of continuation of the previous regime and attempts at changing things more radically, at least at the political level. So that's where the confrontation is, and it revolves also around the government, the participation in government of figures of the previous regime, and the pressure put by representatives of left-wing political opposition, the social movement, and the main force in all that, which is the Union Federation, Trade Union Federation, in pushing for a government which would be free from any participation of any figures of the previous regime. So that's what the fight is about now, with the army trying to play a kind of role in this situation. The army was instrumental in the turn of events which led to the flight of the dictator, because it abandoned him in some way, and it's still here as a reserve force for the regime. And so the situation is quite unstable for the moment, and everything is still possible at this level, that is, when it comes to who will be in the government in the final instance and who will preside over organizing the next elections, because that's also what is at stake.
The government had kept things under very tight control, so are there any alternative structures of power or organizations that could move into the political vacuum now?
Yeah, I mean, the structures of the regime are still there, but very much weakened. What used to be the ruling party is in a state of decomposition, and a lot of people had including the ministers who belonged to that party, formally resigned, so that the ruling party is no longer the ruling party. On the face of it, from the formal point of view. Now, the repressive forces were split. I mean, usually the backbone of the regime of the Ras are the security forces, the police, and the like, and much less the army itself. And so there has been this kind of split in the apparatus, which weakened, of course, the dictator a lot and led to his fall. But the regime, if we are thinking of the social character of it, is not really threatened in the sense that there's a fight about who will be ruling or force in the next period. But even the Union Federation does not represent any radical alternative to what existed. After all, this is a Union Federation. I mean, the bureaucracy of it, the leadership of it has coexisted with the regime much longer, for a much longer time than the short periods during which it clashed with it. So it has some autonomy. But it does not represent in itself, with its existing structure, any radical alternative. Now, within the Union, there are currents which are more to the left, and there's an ongoing political struggle within the Union. But it is the main alternative in terms of existing institution, to the traditional pillars of the regime. Well, aside from that, you find opposition forces, the strongest being the Nahda party, which is an Islamic organization, which has an Islamic fundamentalist background. But it is weaker in Tunisia than its counterparts in some other countries of the region, especially when we compare it to, for instance, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So it doesn't carry the same weight, the same role. Things in Tunisia are very much in a state of flux. We can't even see when they will be settling down. There are attempts by, you know, kind of conciliatory forces to say, well, we should accept some form of compromise and leave it up to the people to decide through elections. And let's organize really free elections for the first time in the history of this country. We'll be able to do that thanks to the what happened. I mean, the uprising and all that. Others are not satisfied with this. And as I said, the key question is who will be presiding over the elections, because, as you know, this is also very important in terms of determining their outcome.
And what kind of role is the United States and also the former colonial power France playing?
Well, both of them. I mean, this country, it's quite hilarious to see how the country was rated by all kind of international institutions, Western international institutions, and when you compare to what happened, Tunisia was considered as a kind of good model, especially by France. But in the United States, we know from WikiLeaks that there was an awareness of the degree of corruption of the regime, at least that's what comes out from the WikiLeaks, the reports of U.S. personnel in Tunisia about the situation there, which actually are quite accurate in depicting the very deep degree of corruption that characterized the regime of Ben Ali. Now, the fact that this regime is completely shaken now is very worrying for both Washington and Paris, from the point of view of the possible repercussions, and especially their obsession, which is the Islamic fundamentalist movement. I mean, any move of such political forces to the forefront is believed to be scary, more so by the French because of their proximity and because of immigration into France. You know, there's a large Tunisian immigration. And as you said, well, this is the former colonial power. There are all kinds of ties between the two countries. So it's obvious that both Paris and Washington would like things now to stabilize. You know, saying, okay, you had your Jasmine Revolution, as they say. You know, trying to put that in the same category of, you know, the Rose Revolution and others. So nothing to be worried about. That was democratic after all. In the last analysis, this is actually a tribute to our Western values, and that's it. But that should stop there. Shouldn't go further than that. And they are pushing in that direction. I think the warnings given by the chief of the army recently in Tunisia came out politically with a statement against the continuing protest is certainly something encouraged by both Paris and Washington. They would like some form of continuity in the state apparatus. They wouldn't like to see that threatened in any manner.
Now, the uprising in Tunisia seems to have inspired imitators across the region, and of course, I guess the biggest being Egypt. What do you see happening in Egypt now?
Yeah, we've seen this Tunisian uprising created a real shockwave throughout the region. And we've seen the effects of this shockwave in Algeria, in Egypt, in Yemen, in Jordan. So it has been quite extensive, and it's not the end of it. The basic ingredients here are, on the one hand, social economic conditions, which were already quite bad. And on the other hand, you have repressive regimes all over the area, and regimes lacking any real legitimacy. Therefore, I mean, everything is there for explosion. The spark has been given by what happened in Tunisia, the key lesson of which, in the eyes of people, has been that, well, when the masses unite in the street and in protest, they can overcome repression. So, I mean, this issue of fear, which was holding back populations in the region, if not vanishing, at least very much reduced presently. And that's also what triggered what happened in Egypt. Now, the difference is that in Egypt, it wasn't a kind of a spontaneous rising in the way that events started in Tunisia, but it was something in light of the Tunisian experience, called for, organized by political forces, by a coalition of forces in the opposition to the regime of Hosni Mubarak, liberals, left-wing forces, and also the main opposition force in the country, which is the Muslim Brotherhood. The opposition is a political opposition to the regime. It's calling, it's in the continuity of a movement that started long before, and which is trying to prevent the present president from designating his son as his successor, asking for free presidential elections and the possibility for people to run in these elections, which actually presently are completely controlled by the regime. The central figure put forward by the opposition as an alternative to Mubarak is the former chief of the Atomic Agency and Energy Agency, Baradei. Mohammed al-Baradei is seen by the liberal opposition and even by the left wing, even by all forms of opposition in Egypt, as the only figure of which has enough international and even national prestige to be able to be a credible candidate for the opposition to the regime. So there is a kind of tug of war between the movement and the regime. If it goes on like that, if the regime proves unable to control it, to stop it, then it will open the possibility for regime change, which would take the form of the army abandoning Mubarak. I mean, the backbone of the regime in Egypt is the army. Mubarak himself comes from the army and his predecessors. I mean, since 1952, the country has been ruled by the military. And the military might very well abandon Mubarak if things get very, very serious in some way or another. You can have some kind of military committee or whatever Beyond that, it's difficult to see any prospect now, in the sense that events have not reached a point where the army, for instance, would be threatened in its structure. So we'll have to see.
I'm speaking with Gilbert Oshkar, the author and academic. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back to Oshkar.
Ultimately, the alternative, all the possible alternatives to Mubarak are not very much worrying for Washington, in the sense that Baradei is certainly not worrying. I mean, this man is a member of the international establishment and of the Egyptian establishment, and therefore it's not a real threat. It's not somebody who turned Egypt into any kind of anti-imperialist or whatever stronghold. That's not what is at stake. Other scenarios, if things get, again, if things, as I said, this is a big if, but other scenarios would be some form, as I said, of replacement of Mubarak by somebody else or some committee from the army, and maybe some forms of, appeasement of the Muslim Brotherhood by a government which would appear as cozying up to them.
When people in the U.S. hear the words Muslim Brotherhood, they think that's pretty indistinguishable from Osama bin Laden. What can you say about them and their role?
Oh, I mean, it's extremely different from Osama bin Laden. The Muslim Brotherhood is a mass organization. It's a mass party. It's a mass organization. And it is basically its political behavior over the decades since Sadat has rather been one of we could describe as reformist, not radical. They were mostly concerned with the Islamization of the culture and political life. They exerted pressure in that direction, and the regime catered to their demands, and the successive regimes made a lot of concessions to the Islamic movement, but they subscribe to a fundamentalist interpretation of Islam, that's to be sure, they are for the application of the Sharia and all that, but they are neither Taliban nor bin Laden. I mean, bin Laden is a terrorist group resorting to terroristic methods and the substitutionist kind of network, whereas here we're dealing with the Muslim Brotherhood, with a mass party, mass organization. It's the same difference, I would say, if you want to take an analogy, that you would have had between the Red Brigades in a country like Italy and the Italian Communist Party at its, when it used to be a huge party. I mean, I don't think that Washington actually put them in the same category. Of course, bin Laden for Washington is public enemy number one for obvious reasons. But the Muslim Brotherhood, there have been attempts at discussing or negotiating, more or less. There have been pressures on Mubarak for forms of accommodation, and there have been a lot of discussions in the U.S. establishment, in the U.S. foreign policy establishment, in the Council of Foreign Relations, and the rest. You have various views about how the United States should relate to such to the Muslim Brotherhood, because after all, the Muslim Brotherhood, during the 50s and 60s, when you had Nasser in power in Egypt, were close allies of the United States and the Saudi Kingdom in fighting against Nasser. They have all sorts of ties with they used to have all sorts of ties with the Saudi Kingdom. They still have. They have also a lot of ties with Qatar, which happens to be the country where you have the headquarters of the Central Command. I mean, the largest U.S. Military base in the region. So, I mean, it's nothing like, a radical force which would really represent a threat or be considered as representing a major threat in itself to U.S. interests. This said, Egypt is such a strategic country that for Washington, the priority would be that the closest and most reliable allies of Washington in that country, that is the army, remains firmly in control of the situation. That's what Washington is concerned about, you know, Egypt is the second recipient of U.S. foreign aid, and this goes mainly to the military. And the United States developed all sorts of links with the Egyptian military, and that's their priority. I mean, they would be really worried and concerned if the army was threatened in any way in its control over the situation.
Shifting the register somewhat, the Al Jazeera leaks about the Palestinian Authority's absolute cravenness and its willingness to cut a deal with Israel has had pretty dramatic effects in the region. What's going to happen to the Palestinian Authority and Palestinian politics now?
Well, to be frank, there weren't much surprises in those WikiLeaks. Anybody following or what the Palestinian Authority has been doing over the years, its close collaboration with the United States, with the CIA in repressive matters, its the ups and downs in its collaboration with the Israeli, also all sorts of Israeli institutions, from secret services and military to the political institution and the rest, cannot be surprised. I mean, the very spirit of what Mahmoud Abbas has been doing was to take what already was forms of surrender and capitulation from the Palestinian leadership, even under Arafat, to take all that further down the road into complete capitulation, and the leaks are just confirming that these people went to the furthest possible extent in betraying their own national cause and making offers representing much more than concession, representing further capitulations. This said, I mean, one thing that came out very clearly from these WikiLeaks, and in a sense, it's a kind of double-edged sword, in the sense that it's, to a certain degree, it's more an embarrassment for Israel than for the Palestinian Authority, in the sense that it is quite clear now that, repeatedly they offered Israel things that people could not imagine be ever offered by a Palestinian team, and yet, and never, I mean, despite all that, they did not get anything from the Israelis. I mean, even in Israel, the government is embarrassed. Even in Israel, you've seen articles and people saying, "Well, we've been told for years that there is nobody among Palestinians with whom we could, you know, do business," and we just see from these leaks that was a lie. I mean, these people were willing to give us a lot, and we just slammed the door. We didn't take advantage of what they were offering, and indeed, I mean, this is the reality. The reality there is that you have an extremely capitulationist Palestinian Authority, but this is not enough for the Israeli government, the far-right government in Israel, which actually is not interested in cutting a deal, any form of deal. I mean, this is the plain truth. And Washington, which has been backing Israeli government throughout this period, has also to be confronted by that, by even its allies. I mean, it's clear that the blame cannot be put on the Palestinian Authority as they used to do before. I mean, that was a joke, but now it's very clearly obvious that this is a joke, that when they blame the Palestinian Authority for not allowing the so-called peace process to move forward. It's very clearly, the ball is very clearly in the camp of Israel, and the problem, and we know that, but it's just confirmed, the problem is the Israeli intransigence. This is the real problem that the situation is facing there.
And finally, I mean, we haven't talked about Hezbollah's role in Lebanon, but you put all these things together, put together the popular challenge to the regimes that have been allied with the United States, and then, you know, the weakening of the Palestinian Authority, the embarrassment of Israel, Hezbollah's role in Lebanon increasing. Putting all these things together, does this constitute some sort of substantial threat to U.S. influence?
Yeah, well, seen from Washington, of course, the whole area is going through a zone of turbulence, at the very least. And of course, it is red alert. It's very alarming. But I must stress that events in Lebanon fall in a very different category than what we've discussed about Egypt, about Tunisia, in particular, and the shockwave that I mentioned. What is happening in Lebanon doesn't have anything to do with the shockwave of the Tunisian events. What's happening in Lebanon is a continuation of the same circumstances and conditions that have been with us for a lot of years now. Of course, Washington's friends have been put in a minority by the fact that one component of the previous majority switched positions and moved to what used to be the opposition and became the majority. So Washington's friends are now in a minority institutionally, and they lost the government. So it is worrying, of course, for Washington. More worrying also is the issue that the new government will most probably just disavow the international tribunal that has been set up with under Washington supervision, about the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri. And that has been very much at the center of the tension. There were attempts at cutting a kind of a compromise sponsored by the Syrians and the Syrian regime and the Saudis. But actually, Washington is the one which prevented this agreement from being implemented. But the result has been the one I've just described. It's here in this case, it's Washington's intransigence that is playing. So it's a different kind of situation. Hezbollah is stronger than ever, one could say, because now, in addition to its military and social force and political force, it is controlling in some way. It is the dominant force in the new government. So Syria behind that, and Iran, seen from Damascus and Tehran, this is for them a victory. But seen from Damascus, what's happening in Egypt and Tunisia could rather be worrying. Syria also, Syria is even more of a dictatorship, actually quite more than Egypt. It's a much less liberal country than Egypt, much more dictatorial, much more repressive state than what you've got in Egypt. And the social conditions in Syria are also quite hard and explosive. And on top of that, the legitimacy of the government is actually weaker even than the one of the Egyptian government. So yes, it's not. Washington can be worried about everything that is happening, but now what is happening in Tunisia and Egypt, I would say, is worrying to all Arab regimes without any exception.
That was Gilbert Achkar, teaches the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. His most recent book is The Arabs and the Holocaust, The Arab-Israeli War of Narratives, published by Metropolitan Books. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about a new political magazine.
All your private property is target for your enemy. Your enemy is me.
That was The Jefferson Airplane, We Can Be Together, from the album Volunteers, a song recorded well before my next guest was born. I hate to be one of those boomers imposing my models on the young people today, but there's something about those lyrics with chaos and anarchy and their pride in it, and the targeting of private property that, I don't know, just kind of found kind of nice. Bhaskar Sunkara is one of the editors of a new print magazine called Jacobin. It's unusual to launch a print magazine, especially a left-wing print magazine, in 2011, but that's just what they've done. You can find out more about the project on the web at Jacobin Mag, jacobinmag.org. But now let's listen to Bhaskar describing the project. He had a bad cold, and it's audible in his voice, thanks to him for stepping out of his sickbed to do the interview. Bhaskar Sunkara. Welcome, Bhaskar. So first, tell us about Jacobin. Why a new magazine?
Well, Jacobin is billed as a magazine of culture and polemic, a bit pretentiously, I'll admit. It's published out of D.C., but most of our contributors are from New York, I would say. We also have a few contributors like James Hartfield in England. But we're just a new left-wing print magazine, and it's a bit of a novelty nowadays. I mean, there isn't exactly an oversaturation of left-wing print magazines. But we felt that a lot of those clinging on, the dissents, even New Politics, were all part of an old guard with roots in the Cold War. And I contribute to dissent and New Politics, and I align my politics sort of closely with the same tradition of New Politics, but these are sort of older milieus. Originally, when we launched as an online-only magazine in September, we actually noted after the fact, one of the contributors pointed out that this was entirely the product of work of people in their 20s. And, there are other publications with sort of young cores, like N Plus One is a great one, which are new, but compared to them, I guess we're very self-consciously focused on politics and economics and sort of serious critiques from most of our contributors, a Marxist perspective. I guess this was really the bread and butter of second-generation radicals. Lenin the lawyer, Kotsky was no academic. These are people really concerned with politics and economics. And, as you know better than anyone, it's kind of a lost art on the left right now. So I guess that's our niche as a new journal.
Do you have some sort of political line? What brings you all together? What's your common currency?
We definitely do not have a united political line. Our contributors are sort of from across the left political spectrum, left, social, democrat. Many of us come from sort of just Trotskyist or quasi-Trotskyist backgrounds, but there's only so much that means in the 21st century. So yeah, there's really no united political line, but it would be from a dissident Marxist tradition. So critique of the left, serious critique of the left, but we're not into just a pure intellectual enterprise. We actually, actually believe in serious political critique for the point of change, and not just critique for the sake of hearing ourselves talk.
I'm sure there are a lot of people who think that kind of Marxist line and terminology like left, social democrat, and Trotskyist are from a different era and one that's gone. You obviously think the tradition is still alive. What can you say about it in the 21st century?
Well, I mean, that's a very difficult question. The point is the same contradictions that existed before exist today. I think a bit too much of a push left, and just in general, in society politically too, discard the old, especially in the wake of the collapse of the Eastern Bloc and the Stalinist states there. And I think that if anything, the left isn't suffering from being stuck in the muck of old left wing terminology, but rather from an apolitical rejection of this kind of discourse and sort of devolution into identity politics and just abandoning class or even the working class as a political subject.
You use the term identity politics with some negative connotation. When in the identity battles of the 90s were going on, most of you guys are, reading Dr. Seuss. What do you make of that? Is that just some kind of ancient relic to you, or does it still have some kind of unfortunate effects on left politics?
Obviously, identity politics emerged, for a reason. You know, the left, even the new left, was, you know, bereft with misogyny and sexism and, you know, racism. I'm not denying any of this. And I'm not someone who has a, I guess, Slavoj Žižek lately has been having a go at the Roma and the politics of what he calls liberal multiculturalism. So I'm not someone with that kind of critique, but I do think identity politics, from my experience on the student left, is still a problem, and it's still something that has a big sway politically. And you'll have people who will identify on the left because of their commitment to gay marriage or other things that aren't necessarily incompatible with capitalist exploitation. So, you know, it sort of begs the question of what exactly is left politics and what is anti-capitalist politics.
Okay, let's just talk a little bit about the magazine itself. Why print in this day and age when print things are dying all over the place?
Right. Well, print things are dying. Print publications do seem to be dying. We hope we found a little sustainable niche. I actually told, I think this was a line that solicited one of our first donors, a writer in the D.C. areas. I told him that he had a very similar question. He asked if there was a market for this and why print when you could just do something online. And to answer the first question, I told him that, you know, if there's a market for all sorts of things, if there's a market for, you know, scatological porn, there's a market for intelligent, thoughtful commentary. Oh, so originally our plan was basically just to very modest, be online, be basically nothing but a glorified blog. And we got, our first day, we got over 6,000 unique visitors. We had an interview with Walter Ben Michaels. It was posted all over the web, only occasionally with attribution, but it was posted all over the web. Once we worked out the logistics, it was really a logical step. And I hate to sound like I'm prematurely jaded, but there's a lot of garbage on the web. So my only concern with taking the leap to print was that we were eliminating the amount of content that we could include, and also sort of unconsciously shaping that content by subjecting ourselves to, you know, certain market pressures. But there's something to be said about limiting space, acting as a quality control. We know that if we're publishing something, we're paying to have it published, and we know that, you know, we really have to debate and think through what we write before we publish it. And, you know, Alex Coburn likes to say that young writers especially should be writing with a stone and chisel, because in the information age, people pump out content. They're a little bit too prolific without really debate and considering what they're writing. If you look at the content on Counterpunch, you might find some irony in that. But there's something definitely to be said about that point. And also, the web is transitory. It comes and goes. Print stays on and evolves. I mean, it might be a little bit anachronistic that we sort of feel this way about print culture, which I guess people think is a dying culture. But I think print still denotes a project as a serious one. I think it helps build an audience. And there's something to be said about sharing a physical magazine as opposed to just sharing a link. I get dozens of links shared to me every day. I ignore most of them. But when I have a magazine put in my hand, it means something different. Aesthetically, if you look at the first issue, the art is fantastic. Our production values are very high, and we have very talented artists working for us. So the style of the magazine is not similar to a journal like Commentary or Dissent. I mean, it's very it's glossy. It's very artistic.
All right. So just give us a rundown of what's in the first issue, and you're starting to work on the second, right?
Yeah, we're in pre-production for the second issue. Our first issue, I guess the main piece of it is an extended interview with Walter Ben Michaels. We also have just a series of essays. We have work from guys like Chris Maisano and Peter Fraze. And these are guys who I think that they've really produced the best essays I've read over the past year on the American left. Chris Maisano especially is really prolific. And I would guess that almost all of your listeners haven't heard of them. And if anything, I think these are people who could write far better than me, think far better than me, they have better wit than me. They're probably a better drinking company than me. But if anything, Jacobin is just an outlet for young writers like them.
And how can people find out more?
Our website is jacobinmag.com, and we're going to be on newsstands starting the newsstands and bookstores starting the first week in February.
And there's a wonderful quote from Burke, right, that gave you the name?
Right. Burke was actually talking about the Jacobin clubs and their publications, and he described them as a digest of anarchy, an uncouth digest of anarchy, or something to that extent. And I did enjoy that quote, so we decided to throw a little bit of salt into a dead man's eye. And it sort of also, there's a little bit of scare factor with a magazine with all red Jacobin on the side of its front cover, even if it is in large bookstores and sold by a national distributor. So we sort of want to cling to our radical roots, even if we are very critical of what passes for the left in contemporary society.
Well, if you're going to give a dead man any trouble, Burke is a good one to give it to. That was Bhaskar Sunkara, one of the editors of a magazine called Jacobin. You can find out more about their project on the web at jacobinmag.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I've been reliving my early 30s, musically speaking, lately, and here's a bit of that. Husker Du's great song, Divide and Conquer. By pointing to fragmentation, I think it's a covert call for solidarity, or at least that's the way I want to read it. Till next week, bye.
Divided by wall, ocean and latitude, and longitude.